Why is that?
You, good question. You know, they count on the stupidity of the American people. Well, you go back to Iran-Contra. Every time drugs came up, the whole session was moved into secret session.
This is Valerie Venice, the general manager of WBAI. We did it. With your help, we made our goal for the Winter 2000 membership drive by raising over $1 million. This is the highest amount in years and was done in record time. Your generosity and your concern for the station helped us do this. Thanks to everyone who helped us achieve our goal. Congratulations and many, many thanks for all the great work of the staff, the producers, and the hundreds of dedicated volunteers who came day after day, morning after morning, and made this possible. Your contribution to this historic effort is deeply appreciated as we all work together to rebuild our beloved WBAI and the network. Again, thanks a million.
And even better than reaching the goal for Winter 2000, we reached the goal for Winter 2002 as well, which I imagine is probably a little bit more. It certainly would need to be. This is WBAI New York. It's Tuesday night. It's 8 o'clock. And guess what? We're not preempted. Off the Hook is on the air.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Oh, Billy Bones was the best to say the worst. I hope that's understood from Billy Bones.
We've been off the air for just so long. It's almost hard to figure out how to use the machinery around here. Not that it's changed, not that it's been upgraded or anything like that, but it's just been so long. And we have so much material, so many things we have to talk about tonight. It's going to be very frustrating, especially since we want to take phone calls as well. This is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you for the next hour or so. And we have a lot of people here with us have a couple of things to say, and hopefully, as I said, we'll take some phone calls. Mike's here. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah, survived the last couple of weeks. Okay.
I have survived.
That's good. That's good. And Auto Jack, you're still here from San Diego in New York. Just can't get away, huh?
Yeah, I'm still here.
It's great being in New York, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Claude.
Yeah.
I haven't left since the last time we were here. You've sort of pitched a tent in the studio, and you haven't left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
I was supposed to mention that, I guess. Okay.
No, you shouldn't have mentioned that.
All right. I guess I should mention the petition to have you put outside in Wall Street. No?
It's part of the new way of things.
Yeah, we're more tolerant now. We're more tolerant of people, you know, camping out here at the station.
But
no, it's good to see you, and good to have all these friendly faces here. And we have a couple other special surprise guests that we'll be dropping in a moment. Let's take a look at some. You guys have any updates you want to give? Because I have a lot of updates here, a lot of things that have been going on.
I'm just looking at your pile of updates, and I don't want to delay it.
Big pile. I mean, I don't know how we're going to even start to get through this. A lot of news has been going on. Some you may have heard of, and some you may not have heard of. Let's see what we can do. Microsoft's new version of its popular media player, which you may have heard of, media player software. It's logging songs and movies that customers play. Now, I don't think anybody can really say they're surprised by this, but that's the way it is. Now, the system creates a list on each computer that could be a gold mine for marketing companies. Marketing companies, what the internet was created for. Also, lawyers or all kinds of other people that want to know exactly what it is you're doing. Microsoft says it has no plans to sell the data collected by Media Player 8, which comes free with the Windows XP operating system. They did say they would change their privacy statement to notify customers about the technology after they've already given it out.
Because everyone reads privacy statements.
Yeah, of course. You have to read every single word of those things. When a CD is played, the player downloads the disc name and titles for each song from a website licensed by Microsoft. Now, I'm not sure what website that is. I know when I use my particular player, which is on a Macintosh, it accesses CDDB, which is a database of virtually every CD out there, and it gets the information. Now, if anybody out there understands how that is actually collected, I'd like to know. I'd like to know if it's something, a serial number on the CD itself. Is it a checksum of some sort based on data that's on the CD? If anyone understands how that works, that's something that I'd certainly like to know. And AutoJack, actually, since you're involved in one of the other projects that 2600 is embarking upon, namely our musical selections. We're putting out films, we're putting out CDs, all kinds of things which will be happening this year. It's going to be a very interesting, kind of weird year. But that's one thing we want to learn more about is how the actual encoding works in CDs. As far as that kind of data, because it's really cool when you can take a CD. Imagine a CD that you don't have any idea what it is; just falls out of your player. It doesn't have, a name of the band, because it's cool these days not to put the name of the band on the CD to make it as hard as possible to figure out what the thing is in the first place. So the only way to find out is to listen to it. But if you don't know who it is, you're really up the creek. So you plug it into your Macintosh, and all of a sudden this nifty little program called iTunes, which is what I use, accesses the Internet, goes out, goes to the CDDB database, or other databases too, which are also out there, and it calls it up immediately. It tells you what album it is and what songs and everything like that. It's really kind of cool. Anyway, going back to Microsoft, there's no easy way to clear out the log that is created, because when a CD is played, the player downloads the disc name and titles for each song from that website. There's no easy way to clear it out without crippling Media Player. That's according to Microsoft. The only way to keep Media Player from going to the Microsoft site is to make the player think it is working without an internet connection, which can be tedious if the user switches between watching DVDs and listening to internet radio stations like this one. And U.S. digital copyright law under attack. This story coming directly from Reuters. The U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has been used to jail a Russian software programmer and stifle websites, some of which we run right here, is threatening the free flow of information, civil libertarians say. They've been saying this actually for a number of years. Their struggle, which will eventually determine the course of how people view movies, read books, and use other material over the Internet, has attracted luminaries like Grateful Dead lyricist John Perry Barlow. We've known John for quite some time, and we know that he's been opposed to this because he's one of the founding members of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Barlow, a co-founder, as I said, of the San Francisco-based EFF, has been at the forefront of protecting individual freedoms online as the Internet matured from the anarchistic electronic playground of a decade ago to the pervasive regulated marketplace it is today. Yes, Mike, that pain you see in your face, I see in your face, that's...
I wish it were true. I really do.
You think that's maturity right there?
No, I wish it were true playground? That the Internet used to be run by anarchists.
Well, I imagine if you went back to, say, the late 70s, early 80s, or...
It was run by the Department of Defense. I really wish that weren't the case, but it is.
Yeah, but as far as actually the people who actually used it, I mean, yeah, it was paid for by the Department of Defense, but... It wasn't run by the corporations. There wasn't advertising every place. It was anarchistic to a degree, and freedom of speech seemed to be the norm. And I miss those days, even though I never really participated in them because, I wasn't around back then. But I really wish it would go back to something like that. And I don't see it as maturity when it goes from an anarchistic electronic playground to a pervasive regulated marketplace. I also don't know if it's really that regulated yet. I think there's a lot of regulation that's in the works, but...
They're starting.
They're starting, of course.
Scary.
John Perry Barlow says, information does want to be free. That's how the human mind works. He also said, he's got the greatest quotes. He always does. He said the DMCA would turn what has become a natural rainforest into a desert. And see what other sound bites I can get here. It sucks, Barlow said when asked to summarize. That's a good one. That's a good soundbite. When asked to summarize what he thinks of the law, it's unconstitutional. Society has certain rights, like the right to know what supersedes the rights of content distributors. All right. And actually, we have an interesting event that's coming up in Philadelphia. Actually, it's coming up next... next Monday, I believe. I'm thumbing through, in case you can't tell, all the pieces of paper that I have here. It's a debate on the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that's being sponsored by National Public Radio. Here we go. It's called Justice Talking, and it's taped before a live audience at the And I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Wistar Institute. So I'll pronounce it twice. Wistar Institute. Because I have no idea how you're supposed to pronounce that. It's spelled W-I-S-T-A-R. It's at the University of Pennsylvania's campus on 3601 Spruce Street. And for reservations, all you have to do is simply fill out the form below. Which, if you don't have the form below, you have to go to this website, www.justicetalking.org/web/tickets.asp. And here's what they're saying about it. And, okay, if you don't have the internet, then all you have to do is use the telephone. If you don't have the telephone, I don't know what to say. But the telephone number is geographical code 215 and exchange 898, extension 7757.
Who will be the panelists for this debate?
Getting to that.
Oh, sorry.
Boy, you're impatient. I'm still going to read the summary of what it's about. Monday, March 4th, 2002, 4:30 p.m. to 6 p.m., DVD code breakers, copyright in a high-tech world. Andrew Bunner cracked the computer code blocking people from copying material off protected DVDs. After sharing that information over the internet, the makers of DVDs sued him in court, saying he is guilty of stealing and distributing unlicensed material. But Bunner claims he only found the code and is not distributing anything he has not created himself. From Napster's file swapping to Bunner's unlocking DVD sounds and pictures, what does the future hold for intellectual property in a digital world? And, yes, the panelists, you know what? I don't have the panelists in front of me, but I do understand that the NYU professor that that participated at H2K, whose name I can never say, and I'm sorry about that, is going to be debating one of the members of the MPAA. So it's going to be pretty lively. So there are free tickets to this. Again, it's next Monday, March 4th, 2002, 4:30 p.m. in the city of Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania campus, 3601 Spruce Street. Call 215-898-7757 or go to www.justicetalking.org for ticket information, and hopefully we can make it down there. And actually, the guy, one of the people working on the story was up here at the radio station a few weeks ago. For
last time we were on the air.
Yeah, last time we were on the air, so long ago. But it was one of the background pieces for what they're going to air at NPR. I don't know when it's going to air at NPR. It's not a live thing. They tape it. So we'll see how that goes. Well, yes, ICANN, the president of the Internet's top standard-setting body, proposed a radical restructuring of the organization on Sunday, hoping to settle questions of legitimacy that have dogged it from the start. M. Stuart Lin, president of the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, otherwise known as ICANN, and a few obscenities as well, suggested at a closed-door board meeting, and that's why, that the group abandon the practice of allowing Internet users to elect some board members. At our request, I guess, right? I mean, that's always cause for concern when people elect board members. And instead, appoint government representatives to represent everyday users.
You know what the ICANN really needs? It needs to be more like the WTO. And this is, I think this is a positive first step.
Well, it's definitely on the way. Yeah, it's, maybe they'll have demonstrations in the street as well, you know, greeting them when they come to a city. All right, well, anyway, the move would amount to a fundamental change in the nature of ICANN, which was created in 1998 in order to transfer technical management of the Internet from the U.S. government to an independent international body. And this is one of the few times I can say that it was better off, you know, in the hands of the U.S. government. Lin said the overhaul would create a more efficient, stable organization that could focus on managing the system that guides web browsers and email around cyberspace, rather than one preoccupied with its own internal workings. Everyday Internet users will be better represented through their national governments and through expensive global elections that may not attract a representative constituency. I'll bet Andy from Chaos is, like, the reason they're doing this. Remember our friend Andy who got elected to the ICANN board?
Yeah.
Through a popular election? Yeah. Well, now they want to bypass that. They just want to appoint people that are already part of the government. The move would also provide more stable funding, he said. We would use the notions of agility and strength of a private corporation with the notion that only governments can represent the public interest.
Oh.
Yeah, let me say that again. We would use the notions of agility and strength of a private corporation with the notion that only governments can represent the public interest. Yes, yeah, so that's M. Stuart Lynn, president of the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, the people that run the show. The plan drew immediate cries of protest from some board members who were elected directly by Internet users. We've just had the equivalent of the President of the United States abolishing Congress. That's according to Carl Auerbach, who represents North American Internet users. Unbelievable the crap these people are pulling and getting away with. This never seems to stop. Okay, as far as those agencies go, here's a notification of a new one. This comes from Bernie S., actually. Bernie S. sent us a mail a few weeks ago. Almost 150 years ago, President Lincoln found it necessary to hire a private investigator, Mr. Alan Pinkerton. He was actually the beginning of the Secret Service. Since that time, federal police authority has grown to a large number of agencies, all with their own little acronyms, FBI, CIA, INS, IRS, DEA, BATF, SSATF, the list goes on and on. Now Congress is considering a proposal for another agency, the Federal Air Transportation Airport Security Service. How does that spell?
What's the acronym for that?
I'm not sure. I don't really have a lot of time tonight, but I imagine it will be printed in big letters on the back of their jackets when they're the Federal Air Transportation Airport Security Services. All right. Here's a letter. We're mixing in the letters with the news stories right now. As a listener to your show from England, it can be difficult to give money to the radio station, but thankfully the WBAI.org website now accepts online transactions, making it really easy to donate online. That's true. $125 to help keep a radio station on the air and advert-free is a small price to pay. That's Matt from Exeter in England. Thank you so much, Matt, for your generous words of support. And thanks, everybody, who supported us. I want to say, you know, that first week, I thought we were going to be on again. I really did. I was kind of surprised when we weren't. But that's okay. You know, the important thing is that the station raised over $1 million. During that first week, though, we were only on for an hour. And in that hour, we raised over $6,000. I mean, we usually raise about $5,000 in 3 hours, but we raised $6,000 in 1 hour. So I think that says something to the enthusiasm of people that the radio station is back and the radio station is important. And if that's not enough, there have been some developments in the world of Clear Channel. Clear Channel, you say? Yes. You remember, we've been talking about them for years. They just keep buying up radio stations, and they just keep taking more and more power. It's gone beyond that. I mean, they not only buy radio stations, they buy the rights to musicians. It's horrible what's going on out there. But basically, if you're a musician and you want to play a concert someplace, well, you kind of have to go through Clear Channel to do this because they control the venues, like Irving Plaza, for instance, here in New York, controlled totally by Clear Channel. So you can't have a concert there unless Clear Channel okays it. Now, what do you think happens to those artists who refuse to go along with this, who decide that they don't want to use Clear Channel to perform in public, that they want to be independent or use somebody else? Well, all of a sudden, they'll find that their music isn't being played on Clear Channel stations. Isn't that weird? And, you know, isn't that also kind of illegal? You know, it reminds me of payola, where, you know, DJs or radio stations will get paid in exchange for having their acts put on the radio. It's a clear, to me anyway, and not to the FCC apparently, a clear violation of what a license holder should be fulfilling when running a radio station. But it gets even better than that. I mean, these people own everything. They own the venues. They own the rights to musicians. They own 300,000 billboards all throughout the country. You can imagine what they do with those.
They own XM.
Okay, that's another thing. XM, which everybody is saying, oh, wow, this is a great alternative to FM. It's not an alternative at all. It's one corporation basically force-feeding you its version of what it thinks radio should be with no local inserts whatsoever.
Use X for the masses.
Exactly. Now, you know, some of the things there are good. They do have some BBC news and some other things, but it's not being created by anybody involved in radio here in a local area, local market. In fact, they had to get permission to put up towers because while it's delivered by satellite, it's bounced by towers, by regular transmitter towers. But they had to promise that they would not commit the cardinal sin of emanating any local broadcasting, because to do that they would be competing with all the other stations out there that aren't really providing any local broadcasting anyway. A lot of them are owned by Clear Channel, but yes, as you said, XM is. I'm not sure if it's 50% owned by or majority owned by Clear Channel as well.
I'm not 100% sure either.
It's pervasive all throughout. But here's something that's even worse. It gets even worse, and I just can't believe it. But they do this thing called voice tracking. And we got this information through Scott over at WUSB and Stony Brook, where this has been a topic for quite some time. This is the horrors of what's going on with radio. Here's an example. WRDU evening disc jockey Big Rig is taking a call from a listener. Can you imagine if we had somebody on this radio station named Big Rig? I can't even imagine. Bill, out in Goldsboro tonight, the DJ says, "How you doing?" "Doing all right," answers Bill before requesting a song. "It sounds like a typical moment on one of the Triangle's commercial radio stations." It's not. Big Rig doesn't live in North Carolina. Big Rig is actually the live afternoon host at WXTB, a rock station in Tampa, Florida. He recently started doubling as a virtual DJ every weekday evening at WRDU in Raleigh, North Carolina. After finishing his live afternoon shifts in Tampa, he begins to prep for Raleigh, using announcements, music logs, news stories, and more sent to him by WRDU's program director. Big Rig records a few hours' worth of spoken breaks and transfers them via email or satellite to the Triangle Rock Station. Through the magic of digital technology, the station is able to insert the bits into its automated mix of music and commercials, resulting in a show that sounds as if Big Rig is here in the Triangle, when in fact he lives 650 miles away. Welcome to the world of long-distance or point-to-point voice tracking, also known as cyber-jocking. The controversial radio practice creates the illusion that faraway DJs live and work in the same market as the listeners who are tuning in. As you might expect, maintaining the illusion involves quite a bit of deception. There's been a few articles about this. Another case in Indianapolis, I believe. Turn on the alternative rock station WRZX-FM, 103.3, from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. weeknights, and you might hear a new disc jockey who calls himself Fletch, talking about getting lost while driving around Indianapolis or hanging around with the station staff at Hooters. From listening to him, you guess Fletch was sitting behind the control board at 6161 Fall Creek Road, where WRZX is located. You'd be mistaken. In fact, there is no announcer in the WRZX studio from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. weekdays. The truth is, Fletch is in West Palm Beach, Florida, where he does a 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. show, as well as the night shift for X103, and in Dallas at KEGL-FM, all owned by Clear Channel Communications. Fletch is able to do this through a process called voice tracking, digital technology that pieces together his pre-recorded between-song remarks with music and commercials to produce a seamless show. Voice tracking enables him to record an entire five-hour shift in less than an hour. This technology also enabled WRZX to do something else: fire its two nighttime disc jockeys, the top-rated Nigel Laskowski and nine-year employee Pete Kilmer. Now it's just Fletch and Christopher Giesen, who works in production at the station but voice tracks the overnight shift from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. "It was very difficult to do, a very tough decision to make, because these guys have been with me for a long time," said program director Scott Jameson. "They were good workers. It wasn't anything that they did bad or that they didn't perform. It's strictly a budgetary decision that is happening company-wide and industry-wide. I'm not going to pretend I'm the only one who's lost his job. This is happening all over the country," said Laskowski, known to WRZX listeners simply as Nigel. "But personally, I think it stinks." Now, the interesting thing is that the dismissal of these two employees saved the station roughly $35,000 a year, which is, God, they're not really being paid all that much anyway. Minus an undisclosed sum, it pays Fletch, which I believe was later disclosed to be about $4,000 or something like that, $6,000, something in that area. Spread that kind of savings over the 1,170 radio stations that Clear Channel owns or operates, and the technology could mean millions of additional dollars for the company's bottom line. Well, this story has a postscript. Dated January 21st, alternative rock station WRZX is searching for a new nighttime voice after firing Fletch, the Florida-based disc jockey who was heard in this market by a method called voice tracking during a 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. shift. His on-air career in Indianapolis lasted all of 2 weeks. He'd been hired as part of a cost-cutting move that also resulted in the firing of top-rated DJs. Apparently, there was some controversy when people found out about this. So this person was let go. But there's been controversy, directed right back towards the radio station. Basically, the person known as Fletch, he was being paid $6,000 a year, I found out, according to the story. Fletch said Jameson told him he planned to hire someone in Indianapolis to voice track the show. Said Fletch, I said, good luck getting somebody local for $6,000, unless it's some dumbass kid just coming out of college. What I say is they should just take the license to that station and give it to the community people who will do it for nothing. And you'll have a station like WBAI there that's got much better programming. It's just unbelievable how they completely abuse what they have. You know, they've got radio stations everywhere, but instead of using them, they just duplicate the programming, and now they duplicate the people. And yet they're allowed to hold on to it. You know, the airwaves belong to the people. I read that someplace. I heard that someplace. It's true, right? That wasn't a dream.
Yeah, it's true.
They belong to the people. So how is it that these corporations are able to get away with this? It's shocking to me. Okay, what else? We've got a few other pieces of news. And we have some other things to get into as well, and hopefully some phone calls. This is interesting. From New Zealand, the New Zealand News. Hefty bill with added insult shocks telecom customer. The company there is called Telecom. Telecom has ordered an investigation after a customer received a phone bill that had an extra fee on it. And on that extra fee, on the actual phone bill, was printed, penalty for being an arrogant bastard. Oh, I like these people already. Auckland businessman James Story discovered the $337.50 charge printed under product or service when he opened his mobile phone bill on Monday. He said he complained to Telecom last week that his phone had been disconnected. He was told it was cut off after being reported stolen, although it had not been. He was unaware of having any enemies within Telecom or any friends who might have sent the account as the account being the phone bill as a practical joke. 3 years ago, he made a complaint because of a problem with the Yellow Pages advertisement for his company, but that was settled last year. How can they speak to their clients like this? He said, it's downright rude. The wording appeared as a normal piece of information under the rental and activity section of Mr. Story's monthly bill. Telecom spokesman Andrew Bristol said the company was absolutely aghast by what had happened and had apologized. Mr. Story has said he will accept the confidential compensation package and will keep his account with Telecom. Mr. Bristol said the company had launched an internal investigation into the unusual penalty and the mobile disconnection that Mr. Story had questioned. Telecom could not explain how such a penalty could have been printed on the account. A reference number, this is great, a reference number which preceded the $337.50 amount did not mean anything. That's what those reference numbers are for. As far as we were concerned, it couldn't happen, he said. Consumers Institute Chief Executive David Russell said there was no consumer law that protected a customer from being called an arrogant bastard. Okay, well, they have fun over there. Can you imagine that, getting a phone bill? Arrogant bastard printed on it? I'd frame that one. I certainly would. This is an interesting case. God, there's just so much to talk about here. At a meeting during Comic-Con International, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund Board of Directors voted to support cartoonist Kieran Dwyer's defense of a suit brought against him by the Starbucks Corporation. Starbucks is suing Dwyer for copyright and trademark infringement of its mermaid logo, a parody of which appeared on the cover of Dwyer's Lowest Common Denominator Number Zero. Dwyer contends that his drawing is a legitimate parody and as such protected by the First Amendment. And basically, instead of saying Starbucks coffee, as I'm sure we've all seen with the Little Mermaid there, there's a picture of a similar-looking mermaid holding cash, holding a, it's like a dollar bill, and I'm not sure what the other thing she's holding is, but this big dollar sign above her head instead of a star, and instead of saying Starbucks coffee, it says consumer whore. I'm going to pass this around, so if anybody is confused by that, please let me know, and I'll try to straighten you out. Apparently, that kind of mockery is not permitted in the eyes of Starbucks.
What is Starbucks so afraid of all the time?
I don't know. I think they're afraid of criticism, like all these big corporations are. You have to wonder.
Like, it's not like they're going to lose business.
They must have such guilty consciences at these places that they have to resort to lawsuits whenever somebody criticizes them.
So it just gives them something to do.
I don't see what the problem is. Every time I look at the Starbucks logo, I always thought it said consumer whore.
Mike, what's the actual website so people can see it for themselves?
This is at cbldf.org. That stands for Comic Book Legal Defense Fund.
Okay, and on there you'll see something that is not permitted on the person's, the Lowest Common Denominator website, because a court order made him take it down. But it is printed on their website.
Apparently you can click to enlarge, but it doesn't work on the printout.
You should stop doing that, in fact. This is kind of scary. This comes from the state of Utah, which is where the Olympics just
took
place.
You repeat yourself.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is called the Criminal Code Definition Amendment. The 2002 General Session, State of Utah. This act modifies the criminal code provisions regarding commercial terrorism by amending a definition in response to a federal court ruling. This act affects sections of Utah Code annotated 1953 as follows, blah, blah, blah. Basically, as used in this part, building, in addition to its commonly accepted meaning, means any watercraft, aircraft, trailer, sleeping car, or other structure or vehicle adapted for overnight accommodations of persons or for carrying on business, and includes A, each separately secured or occupied portion of the building or vehicle, and B, each structure appurtenant, never used that word in my life before and probably never will again, or connected to the building or vehicle. Business means a retail business dealing in tangible personal property. Enter means A, an intrusion of any part of the body, or B, the intrusion of any physical object under the control of the actor. I guess actor means something different than what we think it means usually. A person is guilty of misdemeanor commercial terrorism if he enters or remains unlawfully on the premises of or in a building or any business with the intent to interfere with the employees, customers, personnel, or operations of a business through any conduct that does not constitute an offense listed under subsection 2. A violation of this subsection 1 is a misdemeanor. Now here's 2. A person is guilty of felony commercial terrorism if he enters or remains unlawfully on the premises or in a building of any business with the intent to interfere with the employees, customers, personnel, or operations for business, and also with the intent to A, obtain unauthorized control over any merchandise, property, records, data, or proprietary information on the business, B, alter, eradicate, or remove any merchandise, records, data, or proprietary information of the business, C, damage, deface, or destroy any property on the premises of the business, D, commit an assault on any person, or C, or rather E, commit any other felony. A person who violates any provision in subsection 2 is guilty of a felony in the second degree. This section does not apply to a person's exercise of the rights under the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Now, Mike, I want to ask you, is that last sentence enough? I mean,
I don't understand what this law does.
Basically,
I certainly don't understand what it has to do with terrorism.
Well, basically, they're saying, and my understanding is that somebody who enters into a business and causes any kind of disruption, such as a protester, is guilty of commercial terrorism. Now, that last sentence saying that it's, it doesn't apply to people who are exercising their First Amendment rights. Well, are people who are engaging in civil disobedience, are they widely seen as exercising First Amendment rights by the U.S. government, by the Utah government? You know, it's something that I'm very concerned about, because basically they're widening the scope of terrorism to include demonstrators now,
mm-hmm.
in a very quiet kind of a way.
So, demonstrators must be terrorists.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what I'm worried about as far as that kind of thing. You may recall a few years ago, we talked about various commercial boot camps. These are places that kids are sent when they've misbehaved, except instead of it being some kind of place that's run by a law enforcement agency, a government, or something like that, it's run by corporations. And apparently, they're having some problems. Charles Long II, the director of a Tough Love boot camp where a 14-year-old boy died last summer, remained in jail Monday evening. Long is 56. He's a director of the Buffalo Soldiers boot camp. He was indicted by a grand jury and arrested at his home on Friday. He's being held in lieu of a $100,000 bond. Tony Haynes of Phoenix died on July 1st after being forced to stand for hours in a 111-degree heat in the camp near Buckeye and almost drowned in a motel bathtub about 10 miles away. I imagine the order of that was reversed. Also arrested were two camp sergeants, Raymond Burr Anderson. Raymond Burr Anderson. I can't believe they named him after Raymond Burr. He was released from jail on Friday night. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio has said at least two more arrests were imminent. Basically, we talked about this, where computer hackers were being sent to these boot camps, and they were being run by corporations, and they were being exposed to all kinds of intolerable conditions. And these people, they're not trained. You know, people who run these camps are not trained. They're not under any kind of watchful eye. And then they don't really have to answer to anybody.
If the kid hadn't died, they probably never would have done anything to this place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, what else? So much here. So much here, and we have so much to cover, so I'm going to start weeding things out. Well, have you heard some of the controversy about PayPal now? All of a sudden, it's big news. Remember, we talked about this in early September, that PayPal was a big ripoff. And, in fact, it was because I tried using it once to wire money to somebody, and they wound up saying, on the website it said that you could wire money instantly, but once you did it, they said, oh, it actually takes about 4 days to get to the person. So I couldn't figure out what the difference was between doing that and sending a money order, which would have been probably a lot faster. But the real thing that got me annoyed was the fact, A, I couldn't contact them at all, and B, I couldn't get the money back. I wanted to get it back, but it was being held in some kind of limbo someplace. So basically, they took the money and kept it someplace. And then they actually had the nerve to say that if I did want to transfer it to somebody else, I could only do a certain amount per month. They were limiting money that I actually gave them and saying that I could not give more than this amount of money. It just struck me as being so incredibly deceptive and potentially problematic for lots of people. It seems that there's a lot more of this going on than I thought. Actually, I'm going to take a phone call here because there's a phone number that was given out for PayPal. I actually found the phone number, which you only get under certain conditions on their website. For instance, if your account is suspended, you don't get the phone number. That number, of course, is... Oh, I'm sorry, I dialed the wrong number. A victim of the multiple toll-free number exchange things going on. It's 1-888-221-1161. Let's see what this sounds like.
Thank you for calling PayPal's automated customer response system. To ensure quality and for training purposes, your call may be recorded.
Or broadcast.
If you are calling about a payment made between PayPal accounts, press 1. If you would like help with a bank transfer, credit card, or check transaction, press 2. If you would like to increase your spending limit or verify your bank account, press 3. If you are calling about problems with your password, or if you are having technical problems, press 4. If you are calling about logos or your email address, press 5. For additional information, press 6.
How about to speak to a person? What do I do then? Nothing?
We did not recognize your response. Please try again. If you are calling about a payment made between PayPal accounts...
I'll tell you what. I'll just hit 0 because that's the widely known way of getting an operator. Hang on.
That is an invalid response.
Is it?
Please try again. If you are calling about a payment made between PayPal accounts...
Let's hit the pound sign.
Please hold while we transfer you to a customer service representative.
How about that?
Amazing.
Pound sign. Never would have guessed. Of course... I don't know if we're ever going to get it. Oh, it's ringing. It's ringing.
It's ringing.
This could be a miracle.
Thank you for calling PayPal.
Hello.
This will be answered by the next available representative.
It's not a person.
Your estimated wait time is 16 minutes.
Okay.
Takes us to the end of the show.
Yeah, that's what takes us to the end of the show. And considering we don't have much time to start with, we'll keep you here, all right? Because we don't want, you know, to hang up on you guys. And since you're paying for the call, we certainly don't want to hang up for you guys. So we'll just keep you on the line. And if you come back while we're talking about other things, we'll gladly talk to you. But, boy, it seems like they're really in trouble because everybody's complaining about them now. There's all kinds of websites now. www.paypalsucks.com, paypalwarning.com. Just go on Google and type PayPal and ripoff, and you'll get all kinds of sites. It's unbelievable. Here's a warning on one of them. Your PayPal account can be frozen at any time without advance notice, leaving you without your money for weeks, if not forever, and there isn't much you can do about it. PayPal is currently being investigated by regulatory authorities in 4 states. Well, hopefully it'll be 50 states soon. Basically, you know, the concept was simple. It involved an easy way for you to transfer money from one person to another without using credit cards. But to do this, you had to give PayPal access to your bank account, and you had to give them a credit card number and things like that. So you could forward money to them, and they would forward it to somebody else. But if they suspected anything was weird anywhere, they would suspend not only the person that was selling you something, but the person who was buying it. And all the money that you had put into their system would be completely frozen. And as you can see, it's not very easy to get through to a person. I don't know what happens after 16 minutes, but there's been a lot of complaints. So we're going to see what happens with that. All right. Let's see. What should we do next? Let's bring in one of our guests. Adam is here. How you doing, Adam?
Hi there.
Well, Adam is the person that you may not know right now, but you will know pretty soon, because he's the person coordinating the network at H2K2, which is our next conference taking place July 12th through 14th at the Hotel Pennsylvania, New York City. The fourth Hope Conference. We had the first Hope, Hackers on Planet Earth, Beyond Hope, H2K, and now H2K2. So basically, we have a lot more space now, don't we?
Yeah, it's pretty intimidating how much
it's an understatement. I mean, we have 35,000 additional square feet downstairs at the Hotel Pennsylvania. And what that means is we're putting the network in that area. It means basically you'll be able to walk in off the street and participate, go up an escalator. It's where the Sports Authority used to be next to the Hotel Pennsylvania. So imagine an entire retail store filled with people playing with computers. That's what we're going to have. Now, what are some of the ideas that have been shot around so far? Anything good?
Well, one of the biggest things is that in order to get so many people on the network, obviously we're going to have a lot more wireless capabilities. So mm-hmm. One thing that will be pretty interesting is being on 7th Avenue at Madison Square Garden and hopefully, jack onto the signal. So that's
yeah,
pretty interesting. But we want to keep people inside the convention, obviously, and attending the convention itself. So it's going to be a big challenge to get 35,000 square feet of space networked, as well as the 18th floor, which is where all the speakers will be speaking.
Yeah, now for those people who have been there, actually you coordinated the network last time as well. People who were at H2K, we had the 18th floor. Now just forget about the other floor we had with the tiny rooms. So that's not even going to enter into it this time. We had the 18th floor for the speakers and the network. Well, this is just going to be for speakers now, the 18th floor, and maybe a couple other events that are taking place up there. But the downstairs, the extra 35,000 square feet, is going to be completely technological in nature, and it affords us a lot of possibilities for things to do as far as space. I mean, basically, there are no limitations as far as what you can bring into this thing. First off, it's got a loading zone, so it's very easy to bring a Cray or a Univac or something, to the site and offload it and set it up. It's very easy to do that. We've never had that kind of capability before. What do you think has changed since 2000 as far as technology that will change the way the network is set up this time?
Well, a lot of the network equipment is a lot less expensive these days. So, people who had gigabit switches, like Rody, who brought his switches last time, we can get a lot of bandwidth going around. Granted, we don't have that much as an uplink to the internet. I think right now we have one T1, and we're going to be working on getting some other ISPs into the picture, hopefully. But just the local area networking is going to be, we can get a lot of technology in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good on the radio, I'm sorry.
That's okay. You're fine. We're all kind of, we don't know what's going to happen next, basically, both in the immediate future and in the long term.
But the biggest thing that I wanted to say is the wireless networking. That's what, everybody has. Nobody wants to really jack into anything. Everybody has a PDA. Everybody has, digital cameras. Everybody has, the last Hope conference was pretty interesting, where everybody had something streaming out to the internet, and that was pretty interesting, a lot of fun. We wanted to get our own officially endorsed H2K streams bounced off by NAC, but that never happened. But a lot of these offshoots, people bringing their video cameras, they were streaming from the conference itself, and that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a lot of contention last time with Bell Atlantic, who it's rumored they were driven right out of business after that because of what they did to us. And that's when Verizon moved in. By the way, just as a side note, I don't know if people notice this, but I think since the last time we were on the air, that the building on Pearl Street with the big bell on it has been replaced.
It was there last week when we were on FDR.
We weren't on the air last week.
We were on the air for a few minutes.
Well, we just dropped by as a guest spot, but the last time we did the radio show.
I don't know. I didn't look then.
I don't know. That's what I want to ask people, because there wasn't anything about it in the newspapers. Basically, there's a big bell on the bill. In fact, it was on the cover of 2600 a couple of issues ago. That bell is gone now, replaced by a big Verizon logo.
Sick.
Yeah, it's horrible, because that bell dates back to the 60s and maybe even beyond that. If anyone out there knows or has pictures of them taking down the bell, I'd sure like to know about that. Contact us, lth@2600.com, or write to us here at the station. Continuing with Adam here, as far as the network goes, what can people do to get involved? Because we do need a lot of help.
Yeah, what's important is that people who are strongly interested in working on the networking, first off, you should contact me, and I'll get you subscribed to the networking coordinator list. My email address is arp@metachar.net. That's metachar.net. And just get in touch with me, and we'll get you onto the networking list. And it's not a particularly active list, but we're trying to change that. And if you want to lurk on the list, that's fine, but we could really use some people who are committed to helping out with the network. Last year, I think we were pretty lucky in the fact that we got the network in such good shape in a short amount of time, but granted, that was a bit of luck. A bunch of people dropped out on us at the last minute, and we really wanted to do some things we weren't able to do, such as the streaming, but we could really use anybody who's strongly committed to making the networking happen. Just get in touch with me, and we'll get you on the list, and we'll start making things happen.
As far as I see it, the streaming is great. It's a great idea, but my concern is the conference itself, making the conference as interesting as possible and having it be as much fun for the people that actually show up as is, you know, imaginable. And with all this space, I see all kinds of things that we really just need ideas. We need people to come forth. I mean, we have as much space as a trade show, except we're sure as hell not going to be running a trade show. We're going to be doing something that basically is a presentation by hackers all around the world, where they can set up whatever it is that they do and show the world. You know, if you need a lot of space to do something, we'll have it, you know. You'll be able to have, you know, robots going around and demonstrating certain things. Not robot wars, because someone's already does that, but something different, you know. So everyone will have a chance to do something, but we need those ideas. Now, we had a meeting last month at the 2600 meeting, actually February 1st. We had a network meeting as well, but I think of all the people that showed up there, only one person has gotten back to you since, right?
Yeah, that's true.
That happens a lot. I don't know why that happens a lot.
People get distracted, I guess. But like I said, if you're interested in helping out with the networking, and I don't mean, you know, just I'm looking for people who will do the grunt work of pulling cables. If you have an idea that you want to see something happen on the network, or if you have some time to help out with the web page that we need to coordinate, or if you have some equipment you want to donate, or just whatever ideas you have, just get on the list. Hopefully, we'll keep it not as active as the main H2K2 list, but we could use anybody who has any good ideas of what they want done on the network.
Okay, your email address one more time?
arp@metachar.net. That's metachar.net.
And you can also write to us at offthehook, oth@2600.com, if you have any suggestions or ideas or things like that. But come to the meeting this Friday, 2600 meeting this Friday at the City Group Center. I still keep saying City Court, but City Group Center, 53rd and Lex. We run the meeting from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. in the lobby area. And we'll be having a network sub-meeting this week as well. And, in fact, what we're going to be doing is having H2K2 coordinating meetings on the, what did we say, third Friday of the month at the same location. So that will also be taking place. And you can visit the H2K2 developing site as we start to assemble this thing at www.h2k2.net or www.hope.net. And we'll be updating people as far as that goes. But really looking forward to this. It's more space than any hacker convention has ever gotten before, with the exception of the Dutch ones, because they're outside. So they have entire college campuses. But hopefully we can do something similar in the middle of New York City. I think it would be really, really cool. Speaking of other things that are really, really cool, there was one of these weird perfect symmetry things that happened recently. This is on Wednesday, February 20th. I got this email about 14 times from different sources. But basically, a mathematical palindromic rarity will occur today, not today, last week you missed it, so I'm just going to read it the way it came across, will occur today at 8.02 p.m. on February 20th. It will be an historic moment in time. It will not be marked by the chiming of any clocks or the ringing of bells, but at that precise time, on that specific date, something will happen, which has not occurred for 1,001 years and will never happen again. Hmm. As the clock ticks over time, well, obviously over time, no, the clock ticks over from 8.01 p.m. on Wednesday, February 20th, time will, for 60 seconds only, read in perfect symmetry, 2002... 2002, 2002, or to be more precise, 20:02 for 8:02, 20/02 for the 20th of February, and 2002 for the year 2002. The last occasion that time read in such a symmetrical pattern was long before the days of the digital watch and the 24-hour clock at 10:01 a.m. on January 10th, 1001. But I couldn't find anything, any posts from that era remarking on that. And because the clock only goes up to 2359, it is something that will never happen again. Well, oh, my friends. And Adam here already. Adam here is already.
It's erroneous.
You know, let's let the thought play through here. Adam already has figured it out, and I figured it out too, and I can prove it because I wrote it down.
There are many that disbelieve.
Jim, you seem to have figured it out as well, so since you haven't written down anything yet, why don't you say what you think?
What
is
about 11:11 a.m. on they have date first, the 11th of November, the year 1111.
Well, yeah, okay, that's a good one. But how about in the future? Are we done?
Will this ever happen again?
Yeah, will this ever happen again?
Okay, palindromic. 602112? No.
There you go. No, you're right. You're right. And that's what Adam said, too. And that's also what I came up with. December 21st, 2112, 9:12 p.m. 21:12, 21/12, 21:12. All right, so let's put that to rest.
And there's a deeper philosophical question. If we change the calendar that we use, if we suddenly are taken over by Al-Qaeda and use the Mohammedan calendar or something else that is yet uninvented.
All right, a couple of other really quick things, and I really hope we have time for phone calls, but I'm beginning to doubt that we will. There's a new top-level domain out there called .coop, or as it looks, .coop. And there's some rather disturbing things going on with it. Basically, it's for cooperatives, cooperative organizations, things like that. As is the case with every top-level domain that goes out, I do some investigation on it, and I try to obtain a few. And one that I managed to get, one that I actually have paid for, it cost $160, but I paid for it, media.coop. Now, what better media cooperative can you think of than the Indie Media Center, which basically spans the globe with cooperative media endeavors? Well, after registering for the site and after filling out all the appropriate forms and that kind of a thing, I received mail from the .coop people. And actually, all you have to do is type .coop on a browser and it'll go right to them. And they basically sent mail saying that we have selected media.coop for review. As a sponsored domain, only organizations meeting the eligibility criteria can register for .coop domain names. Our investigation shows that your organization does not meet the eligibility criteria, and your .coop domain name has been inactivated and is no longer available for use by the Independent Media Center on the Internet, effective at the time this message was created. And what they want from us now is all this paperwork proving that we're a registered co-op by their definition and all kinds of nonsense. But I have to wonder, why? What are they going to do? What are they going to do with this media.coop? Who are they going to give it to? Some you know, registered cooperative that has paid a fee to a certain organization and has been registered. The way that they're doing this has made it pretty clear that they have no intention of considering us, because they've already determined that we're ineligible. So it's not like they're asking for more information. They've determined we're ineligible, and they're not going to give it to us. And get this. If we don't hear from you, your .coop domain name will be permanently revoked and your entire registration fee forfeited.
Can you believe, get the money back.
Can you believe that nonsense? Because right there on their webpage, under the frequently asked questions, what happens to the name I have purchased if my cooperative is determined to be ineligible for registration? And basically, let's see, what does it say? Well, I thought it said it here. Ah, here we go. Okay. If you are deemed ineligible, the registration fee less an administrative fee will be refunded. So they basically contradict themselves and
so
have all this control.
For breach of contract.
Well, yeah, I still want to get into all this. I thought, you know, Media.coop would be a great thing to have for the Independent Media Center, but apparently, you know, somebody else more powerful is destined to get it.
What exactly is their criteria?
It's complicated. I looked into it some more. They you have to provide budgetary information and minutes from meetings and things like that, and you also have to be a member of a particular organization that they deem acceptable. So even if you have all this information, if you're not part of an elite group of people, you're not deemed a cooperative. Even though there is nothing more cooperative that I can see than the Indy Media Center. Okay, and let's see. That's pretty much. All we have time for, except for one last thing from Jim, who has come in with a startling bit of news.
Well,
and Jim, why don't you tell us quickly in the last 2 minutes of the show? And again, apologies to all the listeners for not being able to take phone calls. We will do that next week and catch up, hopefully. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, to quickly give you a little history, the second worst kept secret at hacking is the fact that I, Jeopardy Jim, am also Red Balaclava. And some of you may remember me from Hope and 1994 and Beyond Hope in 1997. Suffice it to say that I've been indicted and arrested. And consequently, I'm going to need some assistance from the hacking community. I'm currently jobless. I need to find a criminal lawyer. And there's some other things that people, even not in the immediate New York area, could do that would take very little effort on their part and be very useful.
Can you tell us what they're charging you with?
They're charging me with grand larceny in the fourth degree, as I like to call it, for MetroCard funnies. Essentially, I've been a railroad clerk / station agent for the Transit Authority for some time. I spoke about MetroCards at the Two Hopes, wrote a couple of articles for 2600 magazine. Some people have noticed that I have not given any concrete advice on how to hack MetroCards, just, you know, a general overview. I was very careful to just disseminate what I had picked up from the newspapers, nothing I had picked up in-house. But apparently they're gunning for me because of that. It took them a long time. They never did it directly, but that's the cause.
It was 1994.
Yeah.
Did this the first time.
Hey, they have long memories.
Mm-hmm.
And among other things, I want volunteers who are willing to go and listen to old Off the Hooks and make, since roughly April or June, May, June of 94, and I have a fairly distinctive voice, and if you can find anything I've said on MetroCards or anything I've said at all and write it down, this will be organized. I'll be at the 2600 meeting this Friday in New York. And eventually get a website mailing list going to coordinate this. My trial date is the 22nd of April. If you want to email me, don't just email me with best wishes. If you know a criminal lawyer, if you can do transcription of this stuff, red_balaclava@hotmail.com.
Okay, and we'll be at the 2600 meeting on Friday. I think all of us will be at the 2600 meeting on Friday. So we can talk about these issues in further detail. And again, if you're not in New York City, there are 2600 meetings going on all over the place this Friday, March 1st. That's going to do it for us this week. Again, sorry for not taking any phone calls. We'll be back next week, and we'll try to make up for lost time. Till then, Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Hook. Have yourselves a good night.
We say a goodbye before we say goodbye.
This is Valerie Venice, the general manager of WBAI. We did it. With your help, we made our goal for the Winter 2000 membership drive by raising over $1 million. This is the highest amount in years and was done in record time. Your generosity and your concern for the station helped us do this. Thanks to everyone who helped us achieve our goal. Congratulations and many, many thanks for all the great work of the staff, the producers, and the hundreds of dedicated volunteers who came day after day, morning after morning, and made this possible. Your contribution to this historic effort is deeply appreciated as we all work together to rebuild our beloved WBAI and the network. Again, thanks a million.
And you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. It's exactly 9 o'clock. Stay tuned for Barbara Nimri Aziz and Radio Tahrir.